Hey everyone, thanks for joining us. This is the Anesthesia Learn on the Go podcast series from the University of Kentucky Department of Anesthesiology. In these episodes, we will provide a high-yield clinical review of some of the common topics encountered by anesthesiologists at all levels. The following episode will be recorded by a member of our department at UK.
Don't forget to follow us on Instagram at UK Anesthesia and subscribe to the University of Kentucky Department of Anesthesiology YouTube channel for our video cast. Now fire up your headphones, relax, and let's talk anesthesia.
Hello, and welcome to the University of Kentucky Department of Anesthesiology Learn on the Go podcast. My name is Joe Wells, a resident physician here at UK, here to discuss the care for the patient in the pediatric PACU. The Pediatric Post-Anesthesia Care Unit is a patient care setting that acts as a bridge from the operating room or procedural suite to the next phase of care, whether it be discharge to home following an ambulatory surgery or continuation of care in an inpatient setting. We will cover quite a few topics today, but as a general rule, it is important to realize that most postoperative complications occur in patients under 3 years old, particularly patients under the age of one. These are the patients we have to be extremely diligent in watching in recovery. As a point of policy at UK, PACU signout for children under 6 months can only occur at the discretion of an attending, not a resident. Common issues encountered in the PEDS PACU include respiratory insufficiency, cardiovascular abnormalities, behavioral disturbances such as emergence delirium, postoperative nausea and vomiting, temperature instability, and urinary retention. The most frequent PEDS PACU complication is considered to be post-op nausea and vomiting, followed by respiratory complications resulting in hypoxemia. General anesthesia inhibits hypoxic and hypercarbic respiratory drives, reduces the FRC, and alters hypoxic pulmonary vasoconstriction. All of these can pose a big problem after surgery. As such, special care should be taken to note the patient's age, gestational age at birth, type of procedure and anesthetic, airway management for the case, history of recent upper respiratory illness, and how and where extubation should occur. In the majority of cases, children being moved from the OR to the PACU should have pulse oximetry monitoring at a minimum to evaluate for the development of hypoxemia in the early postoperative period. Care should be taken to position the patient such that airway patency can be maintained, either via the lateral position or with the head of the bed elevated with the neck and head comfortably extended to one side. The use of airway adjuncts such as an oral or nasal airway may be employed. Direct visualization of the patient's respiratory mechanics by an astute clinician is an invaluable part of a post-op assessment, as fog in the mask and gentle chest rise with each breath indicate the presence of ventilatory effort, which may be quite subtle in the tiniest of humans. Conversely, absent chest rise, stridorous breath sounds, and paradoxical chest wall motion or rocking are signs of respiratory insufficiency and should be addressed swiftly to avoid serious compromise. Hypoxemia is defined as low levels of oxygen in the blood and can be caused by low FiO2, hypoventilation, cardiac shunt, VQ mismatching, and diffusion hypoxemia. As a general rule, oxygen saturation less than 92% should be cause for concern in most children and merits swift evaluation. Hypoxia, or low levels of blood oxygen at the tissue level, can occur more rapidly in children than in adults, owing to the increased oxygen consumption proportion to their body size, their decreased FRC, increased airway resistance, and increased chest wall compliance. Check out our Anesthesia on the Go podcast related to this topic put on by Dr. Josh Rock. By far, the most common causes of hypoxemia are upper airway obstruction, laryngospasm, and oversedation. Other causes may include hypoventilation, neuromuscular blockade overdose, splinting due to pain, bronchospasm, aspiration, pulmonary edema, pneumothorax, post-obstructive pulmonary edema, and apnea. Quick note here, as this may end up on your boards. Apnea of prematurity is defined as no respiratory effort for greater than 15 seconds and is a common cause of hypoventilation in infants, particularly term infants less than 44 weeks post-gestational age and in preterm infants less than 60 months. This should not be confused with periodic breathing, which is pauses in breathing for about 3 to 5 seconds followed by periods of more regular respirations. Little ones are allowed to breathe irregularly, just not for greater than 15 seconds, and definitely not in the presence of new onset bradycardia or with oxygen desaturation. Further discussion of laryngospasm and bronchospasm are discussed in another one of our podcasts and should be swiftly identified and treated. Initial treatment of laryngospasm includes administering 100% FiO2, performing a jaw thrust or Larson's maneuver, followed by positive pressure to the airway, and if necessary, 1 to 2 mg per kilogram of IV succinylcholine, or alternatively, 4 mg per kilogram of succinylcholine intramuscularly. Propofol may be administered, but should not delay the administration of succinylcholine should bradycardia or severe hypoxemia occur. Co-administration of 0.01 to 0.02 mg per kilogram of atropine may be indicated if concerned for bradycardia. It should be noted that the incidence of laryngospasm is 17 in 1,000 in healthy children, but increases to 96 in 1,000 following an upper respiratory illness. This is a nearly five-fold increase in risk. Following spasm, patients should be monitored for at least 2 to 3 hours due to the risk of post-obstructive pulmonary edema. Now on to our next topic, cardiovascular abnormalities. The etiology of hypotension can be broken down into three main categories: disorders of preload, afterload, and pump failure. The most common cause of hypotension in the pediatric population is hypovolemia, either from inadequate intraoperative resuscitation or from ongoing losses. Signs and symptoms of hypovolemia are like those seen in adults. Tachycardia, dry mucous membranes, and decreased urine output can all be seen. Infants and toddlers may also have a depressed fontanelle or may be more lethargic or inconsolable. The first-line treatment for hypovolemia is a 10 to 20 ml per kg isotonic crystalloid bolus and should be administered with careful observation as to its effectiveness. If the child is at risk for anemia, it may be prudent to consider transfusion of packed red blood cells at a dose of 10 to 20 milliliters per kilogram. Other causes of hypotension are similar to those seen in adults and can include pneumothorax, medication effect, sympathectomy, sepsis, congestive heart failure, and hypothermia. Hypertension is a bit more rare in the peds PACU, but can certainly still be encountered. The differential diagnosis for hypertension in the PACU should include hypervolemia, a distended bladder, hypoxemia, hypercarbia, emergence delirium, increased intracranial pressure, medication effect, pre-existing hypertension, a previously undiagnosed coarctation or pheochromocytoma, or more rarely, malignant hyperthermia. Treatment with antihypertensive agents is rarely required. Arrhythmia. Luckily, arrhythmias are rare in the pediatric population outside of patients with pre-existing cardiac disease. Bradycardia is the most worrisome dysrhythmia in the pediatric population, as pediatric patients are unable to sustain cardiac output through changes in contractility, as is the case with adults. Thus, a child's cardiac output is a function of preload and heart rate. The cause of bradycardia should be assumed to be hypoxemia until proven otherwise, although it may be from medication effects, vagal effects, raised intracranial pressure, or high neuraxial blockade. Treatment of the underlying cause, often airway-related, may require treatment with atropine 0.1 to 0.02 milligrams per kilogram or epinephrine at a dose of 2 to 10 micrograms per kilogram. Tachycardia may be an indicator of emergence delirium, pain, anxiety, bladder distension, or may be an indication of hypoxemia, hypercarbia, developing sepsis, or a previously unrecognized cardiac abnormality. SVT may require chemical cardioversion with adenosine. It is important to have defib pads on and in place at the time of administration should a systole occur and persist. The dose of adenosine is 0.1 mg per kilogram for the first dose and 0.2 mg per kilogram for the second dose, with adult maximum dosing being 6 and 12 mg respectively. Please consult the PALS algorithm for further information. As a gentle reminder, the attending anesthesiologist staffing the PACU should be made aware of all hemodynamically unstable patients, and emergency protocols should be activated. Post-op nausea and vomiting is the next topic we'll cover. You should check out another one of our podcasts that goes into this in a bit more depth, but we'll hit the highlights as it relates to the pediatric population. Fortunately, PONV is rare in kids under the age of 3, and the risk steadily increases until late teen years, where it approximates that of adult levels. Risk factors include age greater than 3, surgery duration greater than 30 minutes, strabismus surgery, orchiopexy, tonsillectomy, and a family history of post-op nausea and vomiting. In kids, prevention is key, as pre-op carb loading, limiting the use of opiates, limiting the use of volatile agent, and the administration of glucocorticoids and 5-HT3 antagonists like Zofran may help prevent post-op nausea and vomiting. There's also some pretty good data that suggests that normocarbia during the case may prevent PONV. And it's up for debate, but it looks like there's some decent evidence for the utilization of Teva to prevent PONV in the pediatric population as well. In the PACU, administration of 5-HT3 antagonists, if not already administered, and ongoing IV hydration are the mainstays of treatment. The data is still mixed or unproven for adjuncts like droperidol and scopolamine and metoclopramide, but may be considered after consultation with your attending. Perioperative hypothermia. Anesthesia impairs the body's thermoregulatory control, leading to heat redistribution from the core to periphery and ultimately hypothermia when unaccounted for. Pediatric patients are at an increased risk for intraoperative and postoperative hypothermia owing to their poor thermoregulatory capacity, limited subcutaneous fat, and increased evaporative heat loss, giving their large head an increased surface area to body weight ratio. Complications of hypothermia may include surgical site infection, bleeding risk, cardiac events, and prolonged recovery from anesthesia. The goal postoperative temperature for a pediatric patient should be ideally greater than 36.5 degrees Celsius. Hyperthermia, on the other hand, can be a sign of infection or inflammatory response to surgery. Though rare, always consider the possibility of MH as a cause for postoperative hyperthermia, as well as iatrogenic hyperthermia from any forced air warming system. And last but not least, and probably most unique to the pediatric population, is the topic of emergence delirium. Emergence delirium is defined as a dissociative state following general anesthesia and is characterized by agitation, incoherence, and inconsolability. Short-acting volatile anesthetics such as sevoflurane or desflurane, perioperative patient and parental anxiety, ENT, and eye surgery are all risk factors for the development of emergence delirium. It is not directly caused by post-op pain, but post-op pain can aggravate emergence delirium. Prevention can be conceptualized by the mnemonic ADVANCE, A, anxiety reduction. Toys in the pre-op area and the calm presence of parents and providers can certainly help prevent emergence delirium. D, distraction. Distraction technology at the day of surgery may help prevent it. V, video modeling and education. A, adding parents, although this may not be beneficial if parental anxiety is a factor, and that'll be at the discretion of the attending or resident physician in the pre-op area. N, no excessive reassurance. Reassurance is great for kids, but it's actually been proven that excessive reassurance increases the risk of emergence delirium. C, coaching. Coaching the parents by the staff about preoperative expectations can lead to a decreased risk of emergence delirium, probably by decreasing the parental anxiety that then transfers to the kid. E, exposure to the mask in pre-op. Go ahead and show the kid the mask, let him hold it, let him smell it, let him see it. The highest incidence of emergence delirium occurs in patients under 6 and can occur in up to 20% of anesthetics. Short-acting volatile anesthetics such as sevo or desflurane, perioperative anxiety by the parent or patient, ENT and eye surgery are all risk factors for the development of emergence delirium. Emergence delirium is not caused directly by post-op pain, but it can be aggravated by pain, and providers should be on the lookout for this. Prevention can be conceptualized by the mnemonic ADVANCE. A, anxiety reduction, by the inclusion of toys and the calm presence of parents and providers. D, distraction technology the day of surgery, either from a child life specialist or distracting video. Distraction technology has been proven to decrease the risk of emergence delirium. V, video modeling and education for the patient and parent. A, adding parents, although this may not be beneficial if parental anxiety is a factor. N, no excessive reassurance. This may seem counterintuitive, but excessive reassurance is actually a risk factor for emergence delirium. C, coaching parents by the staff that emergence delirium is a commonly encountered phenomenon, that their child will be okay, and that this too shall pass. E, exposure to the mask in pre-op give the kid the mask, let them see it, let them be exposed to it so that they're a little bit less afraid when they go back and are separated from their parents. Avoiding volatile anesthetics whenever possible is also an excellent way to prevent emergence delirium. When a patient is agitated, it is important to keep emergence delirium on the differential. However, be on the lookout for obvious signs of pain, hypoxemia, hypercarbia, hypotension, hypoglycemia, bladder distension, and increased ICP, as these are all actionable treatments for the agitated post-op patient. Once other causes of agitation can safely be ruled out, it is important to reassure the parents and patient and to keep the patient and their IV safe. A scale has been developed to assess the Pediatric Anesthesia Emergence Delirium, or PAEDS. It is a 5-point system regarding 1. Eye contact with the caregiver, 2. Purposeful action, 3. Awareness of a patient's surroundings, 4. Restlessness, and 5. Inconsolability. It is scored 0 to 4, and a score of greater than 12 is 100% sensitive and 94.5% specific for the diagnosis of emergence delirium. The most successful treatment in our experience for emergence delirium has been dexmedetomidine or propofol. Dexmedetomidine can be run as an infusion during the case at a rate of 0.2 to 0.5 micrograms per kilogram per hour or bolused in the PACU. There's also some robust literature to suggest that 1 to 3 milligrams per kilogram of propofol at the time of emergence is also an excellent way to prevent emergence delirium. Other treatments can include a small bolus of propofol, fentanyl, and even ketamine. Airway equipment should be readily available should propofol be administered, as airway obstruction and sedation may ensue. It should be noted that the trade-off for treating emergence delirium with these medications is that treatment of emergence delirium is often accompanied by a longer PACU stay. In summary, respiratory complications resulting in hypoxemia and post-op nausea and vomiting are the most common issues encountered in the pediatric PACU. Careful pre-op and intra-op planning can lead to a smooth transition into and out of the pediatric PACU. Common themes in this regard include adequate intra-op resuscitation and appropriate use of antiemetics, multimodal analgesia, and the use of sedative hypnotics to prevent volatile anesthetic-related emergence delirium. I hope this podcast will spark productive conversation during your PEDS rotation and beyond. Feel free to check out our other awesome podcasts on a myriad of topics, and I hope you have gleaned something from this one. Thanks for listening.
Hey, everyone. Thanks so much for listening. We really hope you enjoyed this podcast.
If you have ideas for future podcasts, please reach out to us via email at learnonthego@uky.edu. Don't forget to follow us on our social media accounts as well, on Instagram and Twitter, UK Anesthesia. From all of us at UK Department of Anesthesiology, have a great day.